attractants and those with similar aromas to known thrips attractants. We've been looking at pyridine and benzene compounds as part of that screening process. We've been, for the work that I'm presenting today, our experimental trials have been are fairly straightforward. We've been field trapping for flying thrips in indoor situations and in outdoor situations, and we've also been using the wide tube olfactometer, which measures walking responses to thrips. Here are some of the results for onion thrips. This is from outdoor trapping, using these sort of white water traps with little lures hung over the top of them. You can see the range of compounds there: pyridine compounds, benzene compounds, and other compounds. The red arrows indicate the previously known best attractants for that particular species. As you can see, we've discovered a number of attractants that show fairly strong attraction for the onion thrips. And some of those compounds were new to science, new to an understanding of thrips attractants, and we were able to patent that group. For the western flower thrips, it's a species that doesn't commonly fly outside in New Zealand, so we weren't able to do outdoor trapping. Here's some of the results from the Y-tube experiments that we've done. The black dye there indicates information from previously known thrips attractants, and the blue is some of our new thrips attractants. Any red from that? So from our Y-tube data, we were able to indicate strong efficacy for the western flower thrips. And here's some results from greenhouse studies, where again, two of the lures that we identified showed very good efficacy for the western flower thrips when attached to sticky board trapping situations. So from that data, we were able to patent this new group of thrips lures. We developed a collaboration with a commercial company and formulated a product which is now commercially available on the market, especially in Europe. The attractant and or the lure, the commercial lure, has proved to be effective in greenhouse vegetables, greenhouse ornamentals, and in some outdoor vegetables. And we've shown that its efficacy in New Zealand and Northern Europe, particularly the Netherlands and Germany, Argentina and Morocco. Now, this is an example of some of the type of trapping that we've been working with. This is a greenhouse, sweet pepper greenhouse in the Netherlands, and shows 2 years of trapping using one of the prototype lures that we were working on and the commercialized lures. And you can see from there that there's good efficacy throughout the season. The red bars there indicate the traps with the lure. The yellow bars are the controls. And we're getting up to 20 times increases in thrips capture with the lure traps. Now, we're in the fairly early stages of understanding what's going on with some of these lures, and we're finding a number of factors are actually influencing how they work. I'm going to go through a few of those now. The thrip species composition is pretty important. This is some New Zealand data, again from a sweet pepper greenhouse, and you can see over up to about week 11, there's very good efficacy of the thrips lure, and then there seems to be a breakdown in its efficacy. Now, if we look at the thrip species composition, we find out that in about week 11, a species, Franklinia intonza, quite commonly in the greenhouse, and it turns out that this particular species doesn't respond to the lure at all, but it certainly confounds the interpretation of the data over a longer period. Thrip's nutritional status. Here we have some wide tube results of thrips responding to the lures at different times after being fed, and you can see that the longer the thrips have not been fed, the more they respond to the odors. And this probably has fairly important implications on sampling resident and non-resident thrips populations. We also believe that there are quite strong host plant lure interactions, and in this situation we're looking at outdoor trapping. A comparison between the effectiveness of the lure in a grass field and in an onion crop, and here again the red bars indicate the lures. In the grass field you're getting a very strong lure effect, whereas in the onion crop it's a lot weaker. So we suspect that host plant characteristics, for example colour and odour, may affect the effectiveness of the lure, and we've got quite a bit of work to do in that area to understand that further. One of the things that we've just been coming to understand recently is that there also seem to be temperature odour interactions, and again here in some Y-tube olfactometer studies we've compared the effectiveness of the lure at 25 and 35 degrees, and you can see from this data that as the dose goes up at 35 degrees Celsius, the effectiveness of the lure starts to break down.
That doesn't seem to be the case right now, but we still have some hope for that. And my kind of time when I started working on those groups were when I was an undergrad student in the forestry department in Warsaw, and I had really very keen interest working on Cerambycid at that time. And my major advisor came to me one day and said, "Adam, give up the Cerambycid. There is nothing you can do about it. It's just overwhelming group. At that time, you couldn't really travel much from Poland, so you cannot get to Paris or London to see the types. But I've got this kind of box with little brown beetles, and I will show you this." So he came over with that box and he showed me a Collidium and Avalonia. I said, "Oh, these are really fantastic." So this was my first really experience with those little beetles on the smaller spectrum, not on that big spectrum of the Zopharycera we are talking right now. But and then since I've been, you know, about 20 years that I had kind of quite intimate relationship with all those beetles and all those which have been included in all this big assemblage. There is three families now that have been lumped together into whatever we are called now Zopharidae. There used to be a Collididae, Zopharidae, and a Monomatidae. The whole amalgamation started quite early, but actually the formal amalgamation happened in 1999. But when we look into the past of all those three families, the Collididae used to be a kind of a waste basket of the old beetles, actually. Whatever had kind of a four-segmented tarsi and a club antennae, that was completely a good candidate for Collididae. So in 1930, Hatchko has put the world catalog, and there were about 140 genera, and all those families, you know, we have started to pulling out were included there, including some Dermestid, Jacobsonid, and everywhere. So I think that process has been cleaned up, and of course there were two now independent families there, including Botryderis and Ceralonis, which are now placed in the superfamily Cucugioidea. Zopharidae, the ironclad beetles, had much less convoluted history. They were included by Solier in his basically Pimeliaeans or Tenturiaeans at that time. That was only the genus Zopharis. Then Leconte had the five genera in Tenturiaeans, and then Horn, and so on. They were And then finally, Casey and Horn came to the two tribes, Usukines and Zofarines. And then eventually, John Doyne and John Lawrence put together the Ulodites, Usukines, and Zofarines into the families of Eridi. The family has been recognized first on based on the larval characters by Beivik and Krychet. It's a kind of a weak character, and it's very hard to see actually. You see into the divide, you know, cardines. It's very hard really to look, but the character is there. Monomadis, that's been a really very clean case since Blanchard 45 is being regarded as a independent family. It's always been in this kind of a Tenebrionoid complex, more or less. Right now there are 12 genera and about 230 species. The only really phylogenetic hypothesis is that one that I put together with John in 99. When we lumped together those families that has been already kind of been discussed, and we recognized two subfamilies, the true Colidiines and the rest Zofarines. The difference was that we moved, where is that mouse? Here. We moved Pycnomerines, which used to be placed in Colidiines, into the Zofarid complex, and that was one of the big moves. And actually, we all owe the initial idea to Mike, who came over to Poland very early in his game and started to talking about it, but nobody believed him at that time. And also the split between the Zofarines and the Phelopsis as a separate genus. And actually, it looks like now the Phelopsis is probably maybe in sister group to Monomatines and not to the Zofarines. That still is to be tested. It's all based on adult and larval morphology. There hasn't been any genes done so far, but I think this is something that we can start with. Technically, there are some synapomorphies, but they are pretty weak, actually, and they have a lot of reversals. When we talk about the Colidiines, actually, the only character that defines them that they've got four segmented tarsi. And of course, there is, I don't know how many times, this tarsal combination in all other groups, including almost all Pycnomerines that have got all four segmented tarsi. And also the groups that have been used in Zofarines are based basically on heteromeron tarsomeres and the procoxy broadly separated.